Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Tony Lathwaite fell in love with wine in the Côte de Castillon, where he'd gone to work as a holiday intern before university. Spotting a gap in the market, he later founded a company called Bordeaux Direct, which has gone on to become one of the most successful mail order businesses in the world. Our intriguing chat covered his love of the underdog, flying winemakers, fateful meetings, and how he keeps Lathwaite's wine ahead of the competition. Hello, Tony, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, and thanks for joining us at the weekend. You've got grandchildren to look after, all sorts of stuff, I know. So, I mean, lots and lots of stuff to talk about, but it's brilliant to have you on the show. Wine legend. I mean, amazing.
Right.
You're so modest
old,
as well.
Old wine legend. Yeah.
Right. I don't know about that. Listen, lots of stuff I want to talk about, but let's just begin with your beginnings as well, because you were brought up in Lancashire, the north of England. You could just tell us a bit about your upbringing, what your parents did?
Well, I wasn't really brought up in Lancashire. We left when I was about five.
Okay.
So right. I don't remember much about the Lancastrian upbringing, except the chimneys and the smoke and the filthy houses. But I still consider myself Lancastrian. I'm proud to be Lancastrian, but we did leave earlier. So I grew up in the south, mostly around the Thames Valley, various places.
And were your parents wine drinkers, wine lovers?
They became wine lovers. My mother was a cook. She taught domestic science, and she would have done a Cordon Bleu course in Paris, she always told me, except for the war. But my father had got a job working for an aluminium company in St. James's. So, of course, he kind of got the wine bug. And yeah. He used to bring bottles home, and they seemed to get quite excited about the bottles. So I would have a sip, you know.
And were they Francophiles as well? I mean, you said your mum nearly went to France to do a cooking course.
Oh, yes. They were Euro-minded. They took me on holidays to Holland and Denmark and places, as well as France.
And you went to Durham University, same as I did, to study geography. I didn't study geography. What, did you have a career plan?
Did you go to Durham? I didn't know you went to Durham.
I studied French.
obviously you're such a... Yes. I had some friends there. Why did I go to do geography? It was all I could do, really. Craning in, they call it. And but it gave me this idea about landscape and countryside and so on and so forth. This has always been very useful in this business.
And had you started to get interested in wine by then? You said your parents had given you a bit to drink, but was it becoming a bit of a passion?
Yeah, well, one day my grandmother met a French lady in Windsor, where we lived, and took her home for tea, as she did that sort of thing. And during the conversation said, my grandson would love to go to France and work, harvest. Because I was true, that's what I said, because through my father, I was interested. And the lady said, oh, no problem, I'll get him a job. And she lived in Bordeaux. What a chance.
And she did.
That
was it.
As good as her word.
And, I mean, that was 1965, you were 19. It kind of changed your life, didn't it?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. I had no idea what I wanted to be. I went out there, and all of a sudden, it took perhaps a bit longer for me to realize that there might be a career in it, but I loved France, and I loved the life in the little village I'd sort of fallen into. It was just lovely.
And you were adopted, not literally, but by this family called the Cassin family, the French family. So they were owners of a vineyard, were they?
Yeah, they owned about 3 or 4 hectares only. But he ran the local cooperative of Puisegain, Saint-Emilion. And I had actually gone to the village to work on an archaeological dig, but after a few weeks of that in the baking heat, I asked him, you haven't got a job at a cooperative, have you? And yeah, he got me one, and it was much cooler in there. And so I washed bottles, washed tanks. I loved it, really, really loved it. Lovely people I worked with, fantastic. And I had to learn to speak because, you know, they didn't speak English. So if I wanted to communicate anything. So I actually managed to learn French in about 3 months. I mean, I'd learned it at school, but theoretically, but I couldn't speak it. But then I did.
And then you went to Durham, obviously, into geography, but you kept going back to France, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, in Vax, I went back and did a bit of a study. I had to do a dissertation. So I did a dissertation on the wines of Saint-Emilion and surrounding areas, because I was in Castillon-la-Bataille. Region, you know, Côte de Castillon. That region has always been a bit upset that it was excluded from Saint-Emilion because it's on the same chalk ridge and everything. And, you know, so that's what I wrote.
And just what gave the idea to start Bordeaux Direct? And I've read somewhere that the name was inspired by a road sign. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I've still got a road sign. I didn't nick it, but I had... A couple of guys working for me at One Harvest, and that was their job. They put up road signs, so they made me one. No, there used to be there's a road south of Castillon, and you come to a junction, and it says Bordeaux par Longon and Bordeaux Direct. And I thought, well, Bordeaux Direct's a snappier one, so I call myself Bordeaux Direct. And I still say to this day, I don't know how many other companies at that time had added the word direct onto their name. Loads do now. I might have been the first to be a direct, you know, something direct, but Bordeaux Direct.
Was anybody in England doing anything similar at the time? So I'm thinking about Robin Yatt, maybe at Yatt Brothers. And were you the first to kind of do that, to bring stuff back from France?
I honestly don't know, but I didn't. I did read about other people doing it, but for a while, and then I didn't. Robin, of course, yes. But apart from him, I think people kind of might have tried it, but it's it's not easy.
Wait, and it was you in a van going backwards and forwards, wasn't it? Basically.
Yeah, it was after a while. I tried shipping wine in, but, in those days, before container ships and containers, it got nicked. Lots got nicked. And it was arduous. And also, it wasn't much fun. And I just loved Bordeaux and the area of my village. I thought, I'll just drive there and get it. And I had a Ford Cortina estate. I drove down and got one lot. And... it was easier than I thought it would be. And it was so much, you know, it was fun. So then I got a bigger van. I got a Ford Transit. And I'd take 100 cases. And so I would sell wine for a month. I used to do door-to-door selling and stuff. And then people would start coming to my little cellar. When I got 100 cases, I go off down to Bordeaux and fetch it back.
And get another 100 cases,
yeah, and then sell the next lot. So that went on for a year or two. I loved that bit.
I mean, what was the UK wine trade like at the end of the 60s? I know you were in France during what you call the erotic summer of 1968. We better not go into that. But what was the UK like then? What was the UK wine trade like? Was it still very conservative?
Oh yes, very, very traditional. We just had something called the abolition of resale price maintenance, which basically sort of it was set up so it's almost a closed shop. You know, that the French producer would sell to a French wholesaler through an agent, and then that wholesaler would sell to a British importer wholesaler, and that would go to a retailer. That's the way it worked, and it was cumbersome, and and expensive. And also, the wine tended to be still being shipped in bulk. And it was, you know, before we joined the common market, you could call a wine anything. And people were, you know, and that helped me later on with the Sunday Times. But at the time, you know, it was fairly common. You know, we wanted a company would just make a Chateau Neuf du Pape or a Pommard. And it didn't taste like the real thing. And I picked that up. What I tasted much fresher and more lively than what came over here. They always seem to oxidize stuff a lot. They like to brown it a bit and take the edge off it.
And how long did it take before you thought you were really onto something? You thought, hey, this is a pretty good business.
20 years.
I mean, was it kind of seat of the pants stuff at the beginning? Was there a point when you think, I might give this up?
Yeah, I was living at home, rent-free, until my dad sort of basically threw me out. And I made enough to live on. And then Barbara joined me, of course, and things got better because she can add up. She's very talented. She was a statistician. And we got better organized. But, you know, even though things grew, we grew quite a bit. We grew up to about 15 million in turnover in 20 years. But it was still, still seat of the pants stuff. Mm. But we loved it. Well, I loved it, and Barbara put up with it.
And I mean, you guys, you've met at university, but you kind of re-met, didn't you, I think, in 1971, and Barbara joined the business. I mean, she's obviously been key to the success of what you've done.
Absolutely.
Just how do you guys complement each other? You know, what does she bring to the business?
Oh, very strong will. Mm-hmm. She's always been able to do the mathematics, but it's... And she's just got a lot of sense, you know, really. That's what it's down to. And but at the same time, she's got a mad streak, and so have I. So sometimes when I deal with other managing directors, she was my first managing director. I've had a few since then. And but she would sort of say, let's give it a go. You know, let's give it a go. And I like that. If any of my current managing directors are listening, you've got to give it a go. You've just got to jump in.
And what do you bring to it? Do you think? I mean, you're quite creative, aren't you? A bit of a lateral thinker.
I'm apparently a lateral thinker. Yes, that's what I've been told many a time. I don't think in a straight line. I don't think logically. I jump sideways, and I don't know why that is. But I'm also a contrarian. If you ask me to do something, I'll do the opposite. But I don't know why I'm like that, but it wasn't very helpful during my academic years. In business, it does help. A lot of entrepreneurs are like that. They because they see it in a different way. And then you can change things, and you can suddenly, it's like getting a gap on the rugby field. You suddenly, you can get a gap, you go for it.
And so do you think you'd been happier, could you have worked for somebody else, or are you somebody that, a bit like me in a sense, you're a sort of natural freelance in a way?
I knew from the beginning I couldn't work for anybody. It's my father said, you know, why don't you go and work for Wine Merchant, learn how to do it, and then set up on your own. And I said, I can't. I just can't. I had one holiday job in this country working for what they call the men's outfitters in Piccadilly. Can't remember the name now. But anyway, it was the same one that was the writer who did Are You Being Served? Who wrote Are You Being Served? He worked there. And Simpsons of Piccadilly.
Simpsons, yeah.
Yeah.
And, Brothers, right, in the television.
Yeah. I was an appalling employee. and I realized that I just hate it. Somebody tells me, go and do this. So, all my life at school and uni, you know, people have been telling me what to do. I just love the idea of being able to do my own thing.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about stories. You know, you've talked about the Cassan family, and I mean, stories are always a big part of your story, as it were, really. And you're very much a people person. I mean, I was amazed, you know, when I went round Direct Wines with you one time, as it was then, you knew everybody's name, you know, from the person, you know, selling wine on the phone, and there are lots of them, to the person sweeping the floors. You know, you're very, very companionable in a sense. Just share a couple of your favourite stories with us that from the thing, you know, these amazing things that have happened to you over the years.
Well, stories, I mean, stories always, I think it can sound a bit dodgy, like I make them up, but all wines have stories, don't they? They have stories, but the important thing is to tell them, rather than, you know, concentrate on this wine tastes of kiwi fruit, raspberries, etc. And it's done malolactic. You just say how these people, tell people how it happened. You know, we've just done one in a producer in Oregon, and his story is amazing. He was born in Iran, Persia, as it was then, and he escaped the guard, you know, on a motorbike with his 8-month pregnant wife, and got over the frontier in time, and then found his way through various countries, ended up in Oregon somehow, and eventually bought a vineyard and makes great wine. The firstborn girl is the winemaker. It's a charming story. And, a wine, perhaps somebody in the wine business would say, well, what's that got to do with what the wine's like? Mm. Well, the wine is good. Okay, the wine has to be good, and it has to be made correctly and ecologically, etc. But that's not what people like to read about, I don't think.
Yeah, and you were one of the first people to do that, really, I think. Rather than, as you said, to say this tastes of blueberries or blackberries or it comes from X place, you were kind of showcasing the people in a way. Would that be true?
Yes, because I think I did that right from the very beginning. 1965, when I came home, I don't know why, I just sat down and I wrote a story about the cooperative I'd worked in. And I had little drawings and a photograph, and I just wrote several pages. My dad ran it off on the office Ronio machine, as you did in those days. I had about 6 copies, and I just gave them to him and to various mates of his I knew, golf people old enough to actually buy wine. And but I wasn't with a view to selling wine or anything. I just thought, well, you should know about this place. Why? I don't know why I did it, but it did. And basically, that's been what I do. I haven't really changed. That's all I do. Mm. And I like to tell you about, two old ladies in Jurançon. And their mother, you know, who make a lovely Jurançon. And it's, it's fun. It's part of the enjoyment of wine, is knowing where it comes from. Isn't it? People, if you live in a wine area, wine country, you go to the wineries and you meet the people. And that's part of the joy. You have that.
I mean, another one of the things you were a pioneer of is looking for wines in what we might call out of the way places. I mean, what have been the most challenging places you've visited in the course of your career? Maybe the most rewarding too.
I don't know if anywhere has been particularly challenging. I mean, the long distance stuff, Latin America, as you well know, it's quite a long way away. But I've never found much difficulty. I was once invited to go to China, and a lady who was wearing Mao uniform, and she came to see me and said, you know, you should come with me to see the vineyards of China. And she said, it's only a four-day train journey from Beijing.
Did you go?
No. I was a bit worried about her. And I don't really know the Chinese vineyards, and I don't really know the Indian vineyards, but we've bought some. We'll try things. You've got to try, and it's, you know, my lot. That's the way I refer to my company. My lot, like, they love something new, from finding something new in a spot nobody's been to before. It's fun.
And you kind of like to champion the underdog in a way, don't you? Would that be fair to say that?
That's true. That comes from, I think, initially landing in Castillon, not Saint-Emilion. That immediately, you know, and all everybody in Castillon said, bastards down the road, they cut us out of the Appellation in 34. And, you know, we used to call our wine Saint-Emilion, Saint-Emilionnais. And, and it is, because it's on a coteau. And now, you know, they've got all that. Put the priest who was in charge of doing the Appellation, he put all his parishioners in. So you get all this wine made down on the floodplain. And, I think, and my customers respond to that. They like the idea of being smart, being clever. Yeah, everybody can go out and spend 400 quid and buy a well-known name, but if you could get that quality for, you know, 20 quid, why not? Yeah. It only costs. Was it Jean-Marc was telling me the other day? His son had done some work, and he worked for Aubryon. The actual cost of making a fine wine, at like Aubryon standard. £17.50.
Yeah, there you go. He told me that as well. I mean, you can afford to drink Aubryon now. I mean, you know, you're a very successful man, but I get the impression you're happy drinking a Côte d'Auvergne or something from the Czech Republic or Oregon or whatever. I think that's true, isn't it?
Yes, I think I'm in the members of the family, and we're a wine family. Everybody's into wine, making it, and as well as drinking it. And they got much more expensive taste than me, my boys. If offered, I will certainly enjoy a bottle of Lafite, but to buy it?
I want to talk to you a little bit about the flying winemaker movement. Was that your idea? It was certainly something you were in on from the start, wasn't it? This idea of Australian, sometimes Kiwi winemakers coming over and working in cooperatives, often French cooperatives. Was that your idea?
Yes. I met a guy called Dr. Tony Jordan, who was a sort of fairly, very senior wine professor in Australia, producing lots of talented winemakers. He'd come over on a holiday and been wandering around Bordeaux looking at the state of winemaking, and he wasn't overly impressed, especially the white wine made in Bordeaux back in those days. Together we sort of said, okay, send me somebody. So he did. He sent over a young guy, and we put him in a co-op. It's actually in the Dordogne. And he made a cracking wine, and it was bloody good. So we made more. Got Martin Shaw, you know.
Yeah, not a bad winemaker.
Not a bad one. He came in the second wave, and he and John Belcham from New Zealand, also a pretty good winemaker, they made a white wine in the Dordogne, which won the white wine trophy at Macon that year. And, you know, I mean, I imagine the Burgundians were a bit surprised, because who thought that there was any wine in the Dordogne back then? You know, nobody knew. Do now.
Tell me also a little bit about direct selling, because, you know, as we said, it was part of the name from the start. You also do bricks and mortar, although on a much smaller scale. Just what are the advantages and disadvantages of both types of selling wine, you know, direct to consumer as opposed to having a physical shop?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we could have gone the shops route. We had a choice, but you heard of the Sunday Times Wine Club? Well,
they done all right, isn't it?
The Sunday Times came along, the opportunity. The story complicated, but anyway, we did special offers with them that worked really well, and then they invited to do a wine club, mail order. So that kind of decided it. I mean, within a few months with the Sunday Times, that's an amazing audience, 4 million readers back then. We were about number two in selling wine in the country, just like that. You know, we had to really figure out how to keep it going and work on it. But it basically, we were a small wine merchant, like loads of small wine merchants. And all of a sudden, we got to be big. Well, you have to adapt. And I think our skill, somebody once said, was you're a small, you're actually a small wine merchant done large that can do big. And that's what Barbara and I have tried to do, and the family.
You've always managed to stay ahead of the competition, and there's a lot of competition now, and yet, as you said, continue to expand whilst retaining this image of something quite small with very hands-on. How have you done it? How have you stayed ahead of the competition?
Peddling very hard. It's not easy. You have to work. You have to work really hard at it, but I think, you know, we've got good people. We've got very good people who, you know, it's like chefs or, well, any kind of creativity. Some people can do it and some people can't. We've got a core of people who can do it, and we keep adding to it. It's a very good ethos, a very good company morale sort of. It's people like it, they stay, and they learn how it works, and basically I think that's what it is. And I think, you know, the fact that the family is still so involved, I mean, we are all in it. That people like that. Because, you know, other people you can go and work for, well, some of our rivals, you know, they're international groups. And they like working with people. And also they understand that we're going to be here, touch wood, we're going to be here. Well, I might not be. Well, I won't be for sure. But the family will still be here in 30 years' time, whereas, you know, in an international hedge fund sort of type-owned company, well, who knows who's going to be there in 3 years' time.
I just wondered how hard it's been to keep it in family hands. You must have been offered, you know, a lot of money to sell the business countless times.
Oh, yeah. I was saying in the 80s, when we became known through the Sunday Times Wine Club, we would get one or two offers to buy every week because, you know, this is the Thatcher days and everybody fancied themselves going to be we're going to be an entrepreneur. We got loads, and we all said no to them, and they got bigger and bigger. And in the 90s, it came down to me, and they got really serious. I can't remember his name, but he was widely said to be the richest man in Hong Kong. He sent a team of six over to sit down with us and buy it. And we just said, no, why? Why sell it? It's a lovely world, isn't it, Tim? The world we inhabit.
It is.
You know, and if you can make some money out, you can live off it. Well, why would you want to do anything else? And, you know, you put the money in the bank and the bank probably goes and loses it. So, no.
Well, I was going to ask you that because, you know, it's obviously made you and your family wealthy, but I always get the impression with you that it doesn't really matter very much. It always just seems a bit incidental. Would that be true?
Well, yes, for me, Barbara likes to tell people that for most of the time when we worked together, she controlled all the finances. I got my little envelope like everybody. I got 40 quid in it every week.
When was that?
That was in the 80s, early 90s probably. I can't remember. But now I've got a card. I can put it in the machine in the high street and it gives me money. As long as that card keeps giving me a bit of money so I can live, that's what I'm interested in. I have no interest whatsoever in buying a, you know, football club.
Or a yacht.
Or a yacht. No, I've got a boat. I've got several boats, but they're all quite small.
Tell us about buying vineyards, because you've got vineyards now in France, Australia, and England. Well, what made you want to grow grapes? Is that a bit of the residual geography in you coming out, do you think?
It was the Cassins. They got me into it, my original couple. They're 3 hectares. They offered their 3 hectares to a nephew. They didn't have children. That's why they adopted me, in a way. And the Jacques, nice guy, Jacques, but he wasn't stupid. He said, no, I can't do it. His bit of the family had a chateau in Saint-Emilion, which is now called Valandro, but they sold it. And, so they could make some money in Saint-Emilion. They saw in Castillon, we can't make money. So he phoned me up irate one morning, said, Tony, you're going to buy my vineyard and I will help you and I will, we will replant it. So, yeah, I couldn't say no. Barbara agreed, and it was an adventure, real adventure. And so, yeah, we got this 3 hectare vineyard. And we didn't know quite how to finance it. So he said, well, write to your customers. So I did. And the customers, bought it on primeur. Basically, they bought it before it was made so we could finance it. And I offered, and they bought the next year as well, and the year after. And so a lot of my, one thing I really like within my company is my vineyard partners, people who've sort of bought into our vineyard and now a few others. And they take a case every year, and it's for which they get a deal, obviously. But I love this bringing producers and consumers closer together. That's why I said I've always been writing about it. That's why we do wine shows. That's why we do wine tours. And it's a joy, the wine world. People should know it. It's not just a drink, is it?
No, I totally agree with you. Your autobiography, Direct, My Story, which I enjoyed very much. It's a really good book. There's one thing you said in there. You said, if it hadn't been for a series of fateful, fortunate meetings, my world would never have moved beyond England. Was that mainly the Cassins you were talking about, this family?
Yes. Yes, I think it was. It was also being sent down. They sent me off down to the Midi. I met a guy called Jean-Henri Duvernay, his family are now they run the biggest winemaking consultancy in the world, apparently. He was a wonderful teacher and inspired me about the Midi and Languedoc wines and so on and so forth, which I still adore. But just generally, I understood much more about the whole technical side of wine. What else? Well, the Sunday Times was a fortuitous thing I'd written. They did an article exposing about all the malpractice in a particular winery in Essex, where and I wrote a sort of semi-funny letter to them. They printed it, and we got a load of letters, and that's what led to them asking us to do a wine offer to their readers.
So, Jeff, you hadn't sent that letter, it would never have happened, right?
No. Yeah. And I must have been drunk to do that.
And malpractice in a vineyard in Essex, right?
No, a winery in Essex.
Right.
A couple of wide lads who had a couple of tanks of wine and were making a whole range of wines.
You've got this amazing experience looking back over 50 years of wine buying and selling. How do you think the wine world is going to develop over the next 20 years? If you were starting out again now as a young man, as a 21-year-old or whatever, where would the new Tony Lathwaite be looking for up-and-coming wines?
Well, up-and-coming wines? Basically, nobody knows. You just do not know where it's going to go. It is changing very rapidly at the moment, isn't it? Geography was very important in our day, and the wine atlas and everything, because that was another thing that was very fortuitous. Just as I'd started, Hugh produced his atlas.
This is Hugh Johnson, yeah?
Hugh Johnson. Yeah. And therefore, you could immediately see where these wines came from. Before that, they were pretty blind. Geography, I hope it continues to be important, but I do see that large parts of the market are just going for grape varieties or just brands, you know. But they're going to dumb down wine so it becomes like biscuits in the supermarket, and it's not going to be much fun, and there ain't going to be much room for a company like us. But you live in hopes that people will, you know, and I still do wine tastings. I stand up in front of people and spout about wine, and I get audiences, so they are interested. They're still very interested. I just hope the younger ones coming along keep the same interest. But that's for my sons to cope with.
And are your sons going to go into the business? That's Henry, Will and Tom, or are they in the business already?
Oh, they're in it. Oh, God, they've been in it for a long time.
Yeah.
They've been on the board for 10 years, and they're now, it's just them on the board. I'm not on the board anymore. I left last month.
What are you, non-exec chairman or something like that? Or
They call me the founder.
Well, that's all right.
Barbara's off the board as well. We both said, well, Barbara's idea is we must now look upon ourselves as the grandparents of the company.
Yeah.
And we can't keep telling, they know better than we do now. And they speak a language of marketing and modern stuff and this technology. I couldn't be speaking to you here today if Will hadn't come and sorted us out. A lot of stuff is gone past me now, but the business side of things. But I can still write about wine and still tell stories, and that's what I want to carry on doing.
But I think you said you'd never retire. You haven't really retired, have you?
Oh no. I've got a list that long of stuff I'm supposed to be writing. I'm like you. I mean, I'm probably not as much as you, but I mean, you certainly put it out. I mean, you're industrial in writing, but I mean, I'm getting there.
So, I mean, how do you spend your time these days? You've got a lot of time with the grandkids, obviously. How else do you like to? You don't need to get away from wine because it's your life, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. Well, I can't get that far away from it because Barbara's got a vineyard a mile down the road. And often needs help when things stop working. I don't want to get away from it, and I love. I don't want to stop traveling. It's nice when I have one of the boys or one of the recently the daughters-in-law particularly came with me. I like to be looked after because I'm a bit vague on airport exchanges these days. You'll see it. It'll come to you. I do a lot of writing, but I have to keep fit too. If you want to carry on my age, you've got to keep fit. So I swim, I walk, I do Pilates, body maintenance. I do an awful lot of it. And,
I like the idea of body maintenance. It makes me sound like a vintage car.
Yes, well, it is. Instead of putting money into a car, my car, I'm not interested in cars, but I figure it's the best thing. I've got to keep this thing going.
And where's your next trip to?
Next trip is to, where am I going next trip? I'm going back up to Durham.
Fantastic.
No, I'm going to knock off to. Well, I have a little hobby with a friend of mine who used to be our doctor. We and his wife and Barbara, we collect cathedrals. We've done all but four cathedrals in England and Wales, and got to knock off the last two because we're getting a bit doddery. So we're going up to do Blackburn Cathedral and then Newcastle Cathedral. And
And call a look at Durham again. Yeah, what a fine cathedral that is.
We'll have to, yes, I adore that place. Yeah. I adore it. That's 3 years. I was at Hatfield. Where were you?
Yeah, Castle, down up the road.
You were at the posh place.
Of course.
Yes. Right, yes. Well, we lived in the shade of that building for 3 years. Wasn't it wonderful?
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Listen, Tony, it's been amazing listening to you. Thank you so much for sharing your time. Bet you're going to have lunch with the grandkids, haven't you, now?
Yes. Up at the pub. We're going up the pub. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Listen, thanks for sharing your amazing story and this life you've had in wine. It's so brilliant to hear that you're still so passionate about the subject and you love the life behind it, right?
Don't you? Don't tell everybody. It's a wonderful world.
Thank you. That's brilliant. See you soon.
Okay. Bye, Tim.
Tony is such an engagingly modest person, despite having created such an amazing business with his wife, Barbara. And he really does love wine. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Piero Mastroberardino from Campania in Italy. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.